This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 23rd of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, Russia has threatened to aim its nuclear weapons at Danish warships if the latter joins NATO's missile defence system. So has Vladimir Putin finally gone completely Dr. Strangelove on us, or is there method to his madness? We'll have that debate here in the studio. And staying in Russia, far-right politicians and neo-fascists threw a party this weekend in St. Petersburg. We'll ask who comes out on top when the BNP talks policy with the likes of Golden Dawn. It's probably not immigrants. And later on in the programme, in the face of deep cuts to Britain's defence budget, the UK's defence secretary says his country will always be at America's side on the battlefield. But is that true? We'll ask if the special relationship has soured. All those stories and maybe a couple more coming up right now on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall. Samira Shackle is a London-based freelance journalist, and Tim Marshall is the founder of thewhatandthewhy.com. Samira and Tim, welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
We will begin in Russia as the Cold War warms itself back up. Moscow seems to have just upped the stakes considerably. Russia's ambassador to Denmark, Vikel Vanin, has threatened to aim nuclear warheads at Danish ships if Denmark carried through its plan to join NATO's missile defence system. Tim, is this just one ambassador who's gone a little bit rogue, or is there something a bit more serious behind it?
Well, there's something more serious behind it, but the Russian, you know, even now, they're not reprogramming their computers and turning them all a bit towards Copenhagen. That's not happening. If you read the remarks in full, it seems to me that what he's saying is, don't you realise if you join NATO's missile defence shield, which we regard as aggressive, that if there is a war at that point, you are a target in that war. I don't think he's busy turning all the nuclear missiles towards Denmark even as we speak. So it's not that serious, but the way it is serious is that it's all part and parcel of this ratcheting up of tension between all the NATO countries and Russia, and that it's getting worse and worse. And each time there's one of these, this is a small incident, but each time there's a small incident like this, it's part of a much, much bigger picture.
And Samira, it's one small instance, but as Tim says, there have been many, and particularly when we look at Scandinavia and the Nordic nations, there was the mysterious submarine in Swedish waters. There's been a couple of fighter jets that countries have had to scramble to see what's going on. This sort of drip effect makes then diplomacy quite difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a sort of process of gradual escalation, as you say. It's this drip. I mean, it's obviously against the context of vastly heightened tensions between Russia and NATO. And I think in Russia, a sense that NATO is edging closer and closer to its borders, and Copenhagen being part of this missile defence programme as just sort of one more feature of that. But from the other side, it's a story of sort of Russian aggression. And I think that comments like this will be met with alarm in the Baltic countries. There's already sort of huge alarm in the previously Soviet Baltic countries, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, about Russian aggression. And I think these sorts of comments about countries in that sort of region are just going to heighten that anxiety. So I think from the vantage point of London, it all seems a bit overblown and a bit silly. But I think if you're in one of those countries that is sort of has a border on the Baltic Sea and is this sort of aggression and this drip is quite a real and present thing, I think it's probably quite frightening.
And Tim, nuclear weapons aren't going to be what this comes down to. I mean, even actually, frankly, probably conventional weapons. The thing that would worry people countries that border Russia is an Estonian version of Little Green Men suddenly appearing. And this is a thing that about the NATO Charter. It's very clear in some ways under Article 5 that if a country is attacked, that everyone comes rushing to its defence. But what happens if actually just 50 guys turn up in a forest? Is that technically an attack if we don't know it's Russia?
That is when you find out how much backbone NATO has got. And I mean, I've been arguing for a year now, that you need to answer Putin's questions before he asks them, because he is going to be asking them, and he's going to fiddle with this Article 5. For example, Kaliningrad is in between Russia and the Baltic states. You can easily concoct a scenario where he needs to go through the Baltic states to get there. There's bits that of the Baltics you can chop off. There's bits of the Baltic states which border Russia where 30 to 50% of the population is Russian speaking. And so that's why this story today about what the Russian ambassador says about Denmark is part of that much, much wider picture. Go back to 2010 when Poland and Romania joined the missile defense. They rattled the sabers and threatened them, but it went away. Obama then froze the whole process, but then in 2013. But then last year, with what is regarded as the Russian aggression in Crimea, at that point it's unfrozen, missile defense is going ahead, and this is all part and parcel of that. I mean, I was interested in what you said about Russia does feel NATO's creeping up to its borders, it does feel threatened. I mean, they can make a case for that, as we'll see in the next story. However, it is also part of Russia trying to expand in that great way it always has done, because it always wants a Russian empire.
Samira, if we were to go back, 15 years, Putin originally said, weirdly, but it's true, he wanted to join NATO, mm-hmm. at the same time as he was hoping to join the World Trade Organization and other groups. Do you think that the West missed an opportunity to actually, in the long term, deal with Russia in a, I mean, obviously, no one could perhaps slightly, really predict where things were going to go, but in a more sort of sympathetic way?
It's an interesting question. I think there's always two parts to making a partnership, as it were. So that sort of has to be quite reciprocal. I'd be reluctant to say that it's sort of just a result of Western hostility that's led to this. I think that it was quite interesting in the House of Lords report on Britain's role in the Ukraine crisis, which was a few weeks ago, I think last month at some point, that one of the things that was pointed out was that, or sort of one of the conclusions the authors of the report came to, was that Europe and Britain, but Europe more generally, had been sort of running their Russia policy on the basic misunderstanding that Russia was on a trajectory towards democracy, and that actually that wasn't true. And it was that misunderstanding led to a sort of huge misreading of the Ukraine situation, a huge misreading of how threatening Russia found it, that a country like Ukraine was going to be joining NATO. And so I think that perhaps that sort of perception, perhaps was contributed to by Putin's comments 15 years ago about joining, and that wasn't really the case. So I think it sort of takes two to tango.
Tim, what's the point of NATO? I mean, when we look at it in a grand
peace.
Well, yes, exactly, and it's it had a purpose, obviously, during the Cold War, and then after that, it's taken a role in Afghanistan. In a sense that made sense as a way of sort of making sure that it wasn't just America and there was a coalition and so on. But
well, the reason's come back, hasn't it? That's the reason for NATO now. I mean, there was this gap after the Cold War. What's NATO for? And there was the defence dividend and all the rest of it, which was complete nonsense and sort of as if the end of history idea by Fukuyama. Absolute rubbish and nonsense. But anyway. And it floundered around for several years, trying to find a role in Afghanistan, which the Americans said, okay, if you must. I mean, really, the Americans did the fighting, most of the fighting. There was several countries which did contribute massively, Britain among them. But then it's rediscovered its role. But the question is, does it take Article 5 seriously or not? And if they go into the Baltics, in the scenario that you came up with, which Putin will ask these questions in the years to come, whilst the defence budgets are all being cut, then we're going to find out what NATO is for. It's either for collective defence or it's to be a laughingstock and it falls apart.
But it's found its reason again right now. Supporters of Russia would say, well, it has created this reason.
They would.
With its, you know, because it's come right up to our borders and we don't want American missiles
this
on our borders.
This is the fundamental misunderstanding of each other. We, and I have this conversation frequently when I'm in the Foreign Office, talking to people and talking to diplomats and ambassadors around London, we do not put ourselves in their perspective, looking back westwards, where they've been invaded 7 times in the last 300 years across that flat land. And every single time we creep a little bit closer, they get very, very jumpy. Now, we know we don't want to invade Russia. We know we don't want to attack them. But you've got to look at it from their perspective, that they think they might. And that's ingrained in the Russian psyche. And they don't understand us, that we are genuinely, most of us, especially in the European Union, which is half most of NATO, we want to be post-war. Now, we're not, but that's where we want to be. And we're not about to attack Russia.
And Samira, if you're in Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania, you know, it's all very well Russia saying, oh, well, it's wrong that, you know, NATO is on our borders and we had an agreement with Gorbachev and so on. But if you're those three countries, which are all democracies, that all feel threatened by Russia, then of course you're going to be in NATO, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they want that protection, quite understandably. And I think you can see the alarm quite clearly in the fact that Lithuania has reintroduced military conscription. And I think the worry, it was interesting, the discussion we were just having about the form that aggression takes and what it will take for NATO to get involved or not, because I think a lot of the worry in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania is not necessarily about an all-out Russian invasion. I think a lot of the worry will be about similar to what we're seeing in eastern Ukraine, which will be Russia sort of stirring up and supporting the sizable Russian-speaking communities in those countries. And that is a much more blurry line, as we've seen in Ukraine.
Let's stick with Russia, but move on slightly. About 150 members of far-right parties from across Europe met yesterday in St. Petersburg to, amongst other things, praise Vladimir Putin and also criticise the West for its handling of the war in Ukraine and to promote what it calls traditional values. Tim, it's ironic in a way that, you know, Putin has made a lot of hay about the fact that there were some neo-Nazis involved in the ousting in Ukraine, in the ousting of Viktor Yanukovych. But he has very little problem associating himself with fascists and those on the far right himself in far greater ways.
Yeah, the fascists, and that's what they were, element in Ukraine that helped to overthrow the government and turn everything around, and they were only a part of it, have their mirror image in some of the parties that are now, that were in St. Petersburg over the weekend. Golden Dawn, for example, the Greeks, the NPD from Germany, Britain's Nick Griffin, who used to run the British National Party, was there, but he hasn't got a great deal else to do these days. All hosted by the Rodina Party, which is an ultra-nationalist Russian party. And they do make common cause, but they would very quickly fall apart. They don't actually like each other that much anyway because they're all nationalists. But one thing I would want to add on, I hope that an event like this does cause some of the left of centre, far left of centre in Europe that have this reflex action about Russia, that because it was communist, therefore it's always in the right and is always good because they're still communists. And so they tend to support what Russia does. This is one of the true faces of modern politics in Russia. And I think that the left of centre needs to understand that when they side with Russia, they're making common cause with what I regard as the extreme right.
Samira, I mean, this is, you know, a mix of, let's face it, not just, you know, distasteful people, but people also across Europe that don't have much power. Perhaps more worrying is the fact that Russia is quite happy to support the Front National in France, and indeed give them ensure that a Russian bank gives them a very favourable large bank loan to support certain nationalists in Serbia, and also we've seen Viktor Orban's party in Hungary as well.
Yeah, I think that certainly is a cause of concern. If you have the prospect of a state backing those kinds of worrying elements and the idea of a lot of money being made available to those movements, I think is something that's quite profoundly worrying. And I think that also, though, it's important to remember that while they may not collectively have a huge amount of power in parliamentary terms and so on. These groups, these movements are on the rise across Europe. Golden Dawn commanded quite a significant proportion of the vote in Greece. You've got mass rallies in Germany by the Pegida movement. And
Hungary's on
the exactly. I think it's not a good picture. So if you have these groups unifying and having more funding available to them, then that, I think, should be something that's quite worrying for everyone
briefly,
in Europe.
Briefly, Stephen, there is also echoes of the 30s in that this is a red-brown alliance. All these parties that we've talked about, like Golden Dawn and the BNP in this country, there actually are quite a lot of socialist principles enshrined in what they say and do, as well as their rabid right-wing and racism. And there is this now, they're coming together, this red-brown, and it's quite frightening to see it in Europe. National Front, Front National in France, again, they have many socialist principles. It's an unholy alliance, but then again, it always was. You cycle around far enough to the left or the right, and then you'll meet not in the centre.
Tim Marshall, Samira Shackle, thank you both for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll talk the special relationship, or so-called special relationship, and one or two other bits and bobs as well.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Top ingredients, world-class service, less foam and pretension, and honest food made with dedication. Monocle focuses on what we think really matters and launches the Monocle Restaurant Awards. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 to hear of the places we value highly, where we want to dine again and again, and where most restaurant ranking lists may not guide you to.
What does it look like? What is the vitality of this place on the street? And yes, the food has to be outstanding as well, but there are many other elements that go beyond that.
The nominees will be announced every Friday on our food and drink program, The Menu, and the winner will be announced in July. Don't miss out. Tune into The Menu every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guest today, Tim Marshall and Samira Shackle. Let's turn now to the UK and the Defence Secretary here, Michael Fallon, has written a piece in today's Daily Telegraph responding to fears over domestic defence cuts and in particular how they will affect the UK's relationship with Washington. Some particular lines here, Tim Marshall. When the chips are down, the UK will always be at the side of the US. Our American friends know that the UK is not about to let down its guard. It sounds a little bit desperate, doesn't it?
My heart is swelling, bursting with pride at the very thought of it. Thank you. I'm almost about to jump up and sing the Stars and Stripes. It's nonsense. Fallon's wrong. Robert Gates was right. He was US Defence Secretary until recently, and he said the UK no longer has full spectrum. And when it took a former US Defence Secretary to say that in public, you know that it's true if he's saying it about the UK. It goes back to 2010, the Strategic Defence Review. Britain started to slash and burn. It now doesn't have an aircraft carrier for another 5 years. The army is shrinking, the navy is shrinking, the air force is shrinking. Where he is right is that if the chips are down and it comes to it, Britain will stand by the Americans. Diplomatically, they will give them cover, as they always do. And militarily, they will still step forward. But it's like an afterthought for the American military machine. Oh, yeah, the Brits are there as well. Let's give them a small job to do.
Samira, there's also a political reason why Michael Fallon might be wrong, and that's that since the disaster of the Iraq War, the British public aren't so keen on us quite simply being in lockstep with the US on military matters.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's certainly true, that we've seen quite emphatically over the last few years with the various simultaneous crises in the Middle East that there's not a lot of appetite for intervention from the British public, as there isn't from lots of different publics across the Western world, I think, in the aftermath of those sort of disastrous and protracted wars. I think there's also the domestic point that Fallon isn't entirely, you know, we are about to enter an election campaign. Fallon isn't entirely just talking to the Americans with his heartfelt plea in the Telegraph. I think he's also talking to the right wing of the Tory party, who are up in arms about this, about the Tory sort of Tory leadership ducking from giving a solid commitment on ring-fencing defence spending. So you've got the former Minister Owen Paterson, I think, giving a speech in Washington where he's saying that Britain's betrayed America and we're sort of by cutting our army and so on. So I think that there's partly perhaps speaking to the Americans, but I think the choice of paper, if nothing else, illustrates that I think it's partly directed to the rest of voices within his own party as well.
Tim Marshall, lots of people in defence circles are talking about the number 2%.
Yeah.
This is the pledge that David Cameron actually forced everyone in NATO to take during the Wales summit last year. He said that every nation in NATO should pledge to spend 2% of their GDP on defence spending. Technically, just about we do, but actually soon we're not going to. I can't get excited about the idea that we pledge to spend a certain amount, because we spent quite a lot during the Iraq War. I don't necessarily think that was a good thing.
Yes, but the UK was one of the very few, leave to one side the rights or wrongs of going to Iraq, the UK was one of the very few countries that could get involved, that had an experienced fighting force, and one of the reasons is that it had lived up to the 2%. The 2% is actually in the NATO charter. It's non-binding. And I think there's four of the 28 countries in NATO, is it? There's only four of them that actually pay the 2%. I mean, the Americans spend a lot more than that. If you do not, it's both a statement of intent, or rather the opposite. It's a statement that we intend to do very little if you don't put up 2% minimum. And as I said, only four countries do. But it's also, you cannot fund your military properly unless you have a certain percentage of your GDP, because you're clearly not buying the kit that's required. And the other side, and I'm afraid nowadays, the other side is people like Islamic State, the other side is people like the Russians. God forbid it should ever come to that. And they are spending more and more and an absolute fortune. So I think the 2% is both symbolic and real and meaningful.
There's another figure, Samira, when it comes to international spending, and that's 0.7%, the amount that countries are sort of aiming towards getting to and what they spend on international aid. And that's something where Britain can actually say, hey, look, we do that, and America doesn't.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think in terms of playing to the domestic crowd, as we were just talking about, I don't know how popular that would be. I don't think it's a very popular measure that we've ring-fenced international aid. I think that people sort of, especially when you have crises at home, people don't want to see that going overseas. But I think it's quite an interesting contrast, I guess, that there's a ring fence around that, but not on defence, but it is a smaller percentage, so it's sort of slightly easier to ring fence.
Okay, if there was any sign that relations between the US and another once critical ally are getting icier, look no further than the UN, where Washington has decided not to take the floor at an annual human rights forum in which member states discuss violations within the Palestinian territories. Samira, the relationship between Israel and the US appears to be slightly flimsier now. Certainly the relationship between Barack Obama and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after an election where Netanyahu soared to the right in an attempt to win votes, said he didn't think there could be a two-state solution, said some pretty interesting things about his own citizens. Do you think this is a sign of worsening ties?
I think that there certainly are worsening ties. I don't think that this particular incident is an example of that, because the US actually agreed with Israel, I think it was in October 2013, when Israel agreed to rejoin the Human Rights Council. The US agreed with them that they wouldn't take part in this annual debate. So Israel's issue with it is that it's the only country that's singled out for an agenda item to talk about violations of the Palestinian territories, and that it's unfair. So Israel's sort of been quite hastily going around various news organisations today, I think, correcting the reporting that it's...
Keith Harper, the ambassador to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, has gone on the record and said that it's complete rubbish, this story. We are not snubbing them. We agreed...
This is a mark of friendship to Israel, actually, isn't it?
They say it's a mark of friendship. Now, the EU did show up and did make a statement, but it said, yes, we call there to be no violations on all sides in Palestine. But no, the US has said, 2013, 2014, and now 2015, we're not going to take part in this charade because it's a standalone thing that every year you just get up and bash Israel. What's the point?
And Syria, for example, isn't...
well, and this is the same the Human agenda. Rights Council when it was named something different, where Colonel Gaddafi of Libya once chaired it.
But behind your question,
you're absolutely right. Yes, it is worse now between Israel and America than it has been probably since 1990. Will it recover? I think it will. I think the trajectory is of a declining relationship over the next 20, 30 years. It will recover, but the relationship is in decline for other reasons.
Yeah, and I think that given some of the statements that were made in the election campaign, which basically, I think, resorted to quite unambiguous racism at certain points, I think that it's sort of given that even before that happened, the relationship between Netanyahu and Obama was not exactly looking rosy. I mean, Netanyahu's quite unashamedly allied himself with the Republicans in various moves over the years, quite a high-profile incident recently with addressing Congress without consulting the White House. So I think that that personal relationship does matter. And then when on top of that personal relationship, you have quite unambiguously racist statements being made. I think, had another world leader made equivalent statements about citizens of his country in an election campaign, he would quite rightly be internationally vilified. That hasn't quite happened, I think. But Netanyahu hasn't been ostracised in that way. But I wouldn't be surprised that there is some sort of iciness.
It's interesting, Tim Marshall, that during the call, they always have to make a call to offer congratulations.
Well done, BB.
And Barack Obama, in the readout after the call, they said he spoke to the Prime Minister about his comments about Arab citizens in his own country. There was that, and there was also, I quite like this one as well, there was a spokesperson at the State Department was asked after BB turned around and said, oh, no, actually, I do want a two-state solution after all. The State Department spokesman was asked, well, why don't you take him at his word that he does? And the State Department spokesman said, which word?
Well, yeah, because he, I mean, the Foreign Affairs magazine had a thing about flip-flopping. Let's take the Arab one first, because I think that's the easiest one. He warned the rest of the electorate, you've got to get out there and vote for me because the Arabs are voting in droves. Now, the wriggle room on that, should there be any, is that an American former Obama strategist had gone over there. He's quite wealthy, and he'd done part of the Arab List campaign, and it had been very, very successful. And so the wiggle room is, yes, or just as I don't want people coming out and voting for Labour or United Zionist or this and that, I don't want them voting for them, but... I don't know anyone that it hasn't left a bad taste in their mouth.
No, I mean, imagine if Mitt Romney during the last election said, put out
black
a video saying black
voting.
People are coming out in droves, quick America.
Disgrace. Yeah, there's very little wiggle room. On the other one, I wrote a piece on the Wednesday. He said, and it wasn't translated properly out of the Hebrew, he said something like, as things stand today, I cannot support creating a two-state solution. And the wiggle room was today. And I wrote on the Wednesday...
He did say, he said to use the word never.
He said indeed. He was asked in Hebrew, does this mean you would not contemplate a Palestinian state? And he said, indeed. Now, the wiggle room comes back. And I said this on the Wednesday, and lo and behold, not because I'd said that, on the Thursday in MSNBC, he clarified his remarks in that time-honoured way. He clarified his remarks. Yes, well, today, the way things stand today. So he's wiggled his way out of it. Obama's got 668 days left in office. They're going to have a relationship.
But it's interesting, Samira, isn't it, that actually amongst Palestinian leadership, they were in many ways delighted because they would say, well, look, this just proves that we don't have a partner in peace.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think also, I mean, Netanyahu has, I think, throughout his political career shown that he's quite happy to say one thing campaigning and another thing in office. So he doesn't have any qualms about sort of changing what he says. But I think that's certainly true. It does illustrate quite clearly that Israel under Netanyahu is not a willing partner in negotiations. But I think it's also quite worrying for anyone who does want to see a resumption of diplomatic solution.
I'm afraid we're going to leave it there. We were going to talk about Ted Cruz becoming potentially a Republican candidate. That will have to wait for tonight's Daily. Do tune in, 2200 hours London time. They'll be talking about that. That's it for today's Midori House. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hewin. At the studio manager, it was Toby Hammond. Culture with Rob is up at 1900 hours. We're back same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.